Well, I was excited to get the theme from the committee. I don't actually select the theme I preach on every year. It's sort of exhilarating to actually preach about something that I may not have any knowledge about. There are many topics that I know nothing. I have strong opinions, but I know nothing. But so when I got survival, I thought how interesting that members of our church are today marching in New York City in the great climate change parade and greater awareness. Last week, I gave a sermon, which is maybe a trifle bit dark, and two separate members, one member and actually a visitor, came up and said, actually, things have never been better. And they were correct in what they talked about. But we all have this uneasy feeling that we are living in treacherous and desperate times. So this annual opportunity to honor the past also inevitably hurls me into today's headlines. It's absolutely inescapable. And so when the topic of survival came to me, I thought immediately back to what our forebears, the Puritans who founded the Mass Bay Colony, they called it their errand into the wilderness. They didn't see hovering, you know, on the eastern seaboard here in New England as anything other than a desperate venture into the unknown. And it was hard, and it was extraordinarily difficult. And they created a city, but in their eyes, it was a city formed in the midst of a howling, savage wilderness. But they survived, and they prospered. They did well. And partly, I believe their inner power was that they believed, and I would add, they knew, that they were part of the unveiling of what I would call a deep history, an unfolding, an apocalypse. Apocalypse means, from a Greek word, to reveal. It is to unravel a secret that has been there from the very beginning, but is only now being revealed in the end times. Increase Mather, one of my forebears, in fact, his portrait is in the office. He said, yes, pay attention to the comets. Those are signs of wonder of the day of judgment. But also, quote, droughts, caterpillars, tempests, indolations, sickness, all of these signs, a warning piece, and I really want you to hear this, because this encapsulates apocalyptic thinking. And these are our forebears. A warning piece that a merciful God will soon discharge before his murdering pieces go off. If you think that the Puritans are past, think again, for we live still in apocalyptic times. And what did our Puritan, and I gotta add, even if you have just arrived in America 2 weeks ago from China or Holland or Nairobi, trust me, in America, the Puritans are still gonna haunt you. What did our ancestors believe? Our cultural ancestors, the people that made the American DNA. And they, first of all, saw themselves deeply as survivors. Not only because living on these shores was a precarious and deadly and dangerous enterprise, but because what they believed, their theology, poised them to think of themselves quite literally as God's survivors, living in the end time. And that self-understanding was fueled by their reading of the book of Revelations, the book of Daniel, and also the great Hebrew prophets. And they're populating these shores and separating out from what they perceived as a corrupt church was literally the fulfillment of biblical prophecies. It was a scenario that God was working out precisely through their actions. They weren't coming to escape. They were coming to fulfill. That's what they believed. And so the wonders that they watched for in the sky and in the city and in the population and all around them, they watched for were signals that what they believed was imminent. The end was now, and they were it. In 1662, America's first bestseller, and I know you've read it 1,000 times, Michael Wigglesworth's Day of Doom. It still gives me a charge. I'm one in every 25 New Englanders at the time owned it. Children memorized it before they went to bed at night. 224 8-line stanzas. I'm just going to give you one. I need my glasses. With iron bands they bind their hands and cursed feet together, and cast them all, both great and small, into that lake forever, where day and night without respite they wail and cry and howl for torturing pain which they sustain in body and in soul. You want more? Oh, maybe that's enough. That's enough. Professor Paul Boyer says that the energy of Puritanism was literally an apocalyptic energy. And this energy worked through them in two ways. One, obviously, was to terrorize and therefore motivate. But the other was somehow different. It was to convey to each and all that they were somehow the new chosen people, that these prophecies, these wonders pertaining to the Israelites were now being fulfilled in their lifetime and in them. The city on a hill was the new Jerusalem. And it was also the point of terror in the day of doom. It was both these things together, held in suspension. One led into the other, and the other bled right back. And then the question, which I know you're asking yourselves in the pews this morning, is, did they feel damned, or did they feel blessed? And the answer is they felt both, which is the classic Puritan anxiety. And it still is with Americans today. It hasn't gone away. Julia Ward Howe, in the middle of the Civil War, living on Chestnut Street, where I live today, she wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And maybe you've sung it so many times that you just don't even hear anymore that it is an apocalyptic hymn. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. The vision in the midst of the Civil War of God's terrible, swift sword is precisely this energy. It is precisely that energy that fueled so many of our emotions after 9/11, when the strong American impulse was to go and somehow purify as well as police the world, and we're gearing up to do it again. As Winthrop said, the eyes of the world are upon us. We are as a city upon a hill, raised up. Well, you know, I grew up with this in the 1960s, Barry Maguire's Eve of Destruction. Any baby boomers out there remember that? And you tell me over and over, my friend, that you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. That's the weird thing about apocalypse. It just seems to pay off in the long run because it doesn't seem to arrive. And for my children, REMs, it's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. But for me, and I have followed Bob Dylan from the beginning of his career to today, he is the classic American apocalyptic prophet, all the way from A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, which he wrote in the midst of the fear of nuclear destruction. He wrote this 7-minute song. Every line he said was a song that he feared he would never get to write. But it really finds its classic expression in a song, Precious Angel, from his gospel phase. It is the most terrifying line from American popular music that I can imagine. My so-called friends have fallen under a spell. They look me in the eye and say, all is well. Can they imagine the darkness that will fall from on high when men will beg to God to kill them and they won't be able to die? The Puritans are with us. Not in the long past. Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth is one of the best-selling books of the last 50 years, and the 11 volumes of the Left Behind series is not far behind. Boston novelist Tom Peretta, his bestseller, The Leftovers, is about the rapture of 20% of the population, and now it's an HBO series. And it's probably the most despairing television show ever made, because there's no explanation. God speaks through the rapture, but speaks no meaning. And everyone who remains behind, the leftovers, wonder what is it like to live in this time that is the end time. The comets, the hideous fevers and diseases, the tales of war and rumors of war, the discord abroad, the onslaught of the other, imperiling our culture, and most of all, our continued delight in apocalypse, all these things we carry with us today. They are part of our emotional baggage. We can make fun of our ancestors until we realize how powerfully they are still speaking in and through us. But this, again, is nothing new. One of the great lost stories in Boston life is after the Great Comet of 1843, literally hundreds of thousands of Americans concluded that the world was coming to an end. And there arose a prophet named William Miller. They called themselves the Millerites. And they were basically based in Boston, and after careful calculations, the Millerites believed that basically the world was going to come to an end on October 22nd, 1844. Emerson writes about them. One Millerite came up to Emerson and asked him if he were ready, and he said, "Well, let the world go. We can get along just as well without it." And so the people waited. People quit their jobs. They left their churches. They gave away their belongings. And they waited. 200 ordained ministers and 2,000 lay preachers arose to say that this was the end. That's the funny thing about apocalypse. It just keeps going on. And if you want to make fun of the Millerites, well, guess what? They survived today. It's the Seventh-day Adventists. And before you snotty little Unitarian Universalists think hardly of them, they have 25 million adherents, so what about that? Indeed, my predecessor, Cotton Mather, actually also tried to come up with a precise date of the end of the world. First, he concluded that it was 1697, and when that date passed, he decided to recalculate, as folks always do, and he became convinced it was 1716, and 1716 was a very important year, but he concluded, when nothing happened, that it was 1717, and that date passed, and at the end of his life, he concluded 1727 just might be the ticket. And I have concluded that I better check my contract. It might be there in a hidden clause that I should be guiding you all to a more precise timetable. Now, the problem with all these frenzied efforts, they're all on a fool's errand. And that's not from me, a grizzled Unitarian Universalist rationalist, but from the Gospels themselves. Matthew 24:36. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. And from Acts 1:9, it is not for you to know the times or the seasons. The problem with apocalyptic fever is that it often doesn't confront the future with much faith. It is a rather fatalistic and entrenched mode of spiritual life. It ignores an open-hearted confrontation of the future, which was expressed by the Puritan divine John Robinson, who said, "The Lord has more truth and light yet to break forth from his holy word." That is a much more open-hearted, open-minded, and free attitude. And the problem with the apocalypse is not that it doesn't come, but rather that it pervades our time so deeply, whether it comes or not, that we can often be invited or seduced into cowering in fear and trembling, even if we think we've moved on from our forebears. As I said, apocalypse comes from the Greek word to uncover or disclose. That what was hidden is now revealed. It is the unraveling of a mystery whose unfolding has been there all along. And in that sense, you and I, we are all survivors, all of us. And as such, we live in times of responsibility. And our task, as with our forebears, is to live mindful of end times without being seduced by their stark visionary power. Because to be caught in that net is to be utterly paralyzed. The Puritans' world of wonder does not need to be ours as we search in our own time for signs and wonders. My favorite story about all this is that Professor Lovering, the Harvard physics professor, had a two-part series. He used to deliver it at lyceums and gatherings all over New England. And the first part was how likely it was that the world would be hit by a giant comet and all life would end. The second part was a close mathematical depiction of how unlikely that was to be. Well, apparently, he was invited to speak in Plymouth. And he rose and he gave the first part and then sat down. And the people were just unnerved, as you can imagine. And the chairman rose and said, "Can you offer us, Professor Livering, no comfort?" And he said, "Well, not for only $50. We live in times where we are responsible. We are responsible for the age in which we live and how we conduct ourselves. We no longer have what our forebears had, the sense of Jehovah of plotting our doom or plotting and building a new Jerusalem. We live in a time where we are convinced that God will not save us other than that God, and that's why this is an interfaith service, other than that God which speaks through our respective faiths, through our reason, and most of all through our compassion, to work to save ourselves. Our challenges may, despite our comforts in modernity, may be even greater than what our Puritan forebears faced, and our capacity to acknowledge end times are just as great as theirs. But for one manner or the other, we are not fated by divine decree, as our ancestors believed. We are in the serious and not always encouraging flow of history. But we are not trapped in it. We are not trapped in fate or providence or apocalypse now. And here's what I've learned about apocalypse. When I read that Michael Wigglesworth piece, the question is always asked, were they scared when they shared this dark apocalyptic vision? And the answer is, I suspect not really. They were thrilled at the drama of living in the end times. Just like we are when we turn on The Walking Dead on AMC. They were thrilled and immensely reassured by this vision. Few souls believe in the end, that no matter how they beat their chests and bow their brows, ultimately believe that they will be on the wrong end of God's stick. They might, but you know, their neighbor looks far more likely than they do. And so the end of the world wasn't so much about the world ending, is rather about how they chose to organize their world. Each generation expected the end time, and each in turn was disappointed, but the sliding date served to make history imminent, immense, and important. If you were living in the last generation, then you are living in the greatest generation of all, when the sheep are going to be separated from the goats, and the faithful and the flock will be saved. We Americans are intoxicated by the apocalypse. We are deeply attached and attuned to it. It's in us in a very deep way. But something has changed, and something powerful. We are now linked to the Puritans in so many ways. But even if we, like they, see ourselves as survivors, is living not in a howling wilderness, but rather in an sometimes unforgiving cosmos. What has been lost is not fear. What has been lost is the old organizing meaning. If we fear the end time, and I noticed on BuzzFeed the other day, an article, 10 Ways to Die You Haven't Thought of Yet. And we clearly do. It will arrive not as a God-inspired tableau. It will not be what God wishes for us. And if we still see ourselves as survivors, then we no longer have to feel the long oppression of helplessness. There are so many psychological angles of living with apocalypse. But one of the most unattractive was that old and ancient temptation for the separation of saints and sinners, a feeling that the world was threaded with threat and that the day of judgment was going to arrive with eternal hellfire. That was a profound fear. It is one we no longer need luxuriate or indulge or hold. But we are still survivors. But now, we are cast together as one. No longer heretics and heroes, but merely human and hopefully humane. Fellow travelers, in this time that we have been given. Amen.